Welcome to the next edition of Irish Illustrated Insider, brought to you by IrishIllustrated.com. I'm Pete Sampson with Tim O'Malley, two-man booth today. We've got plenty of news to get to. Tim, you were out at hoops practice. We want to talk a little bit about that. We've got some scheduling news, Arkansas coming on. I sat down with Jack Swarbrick actually this morning to talk quite a bit about scheduling, among other things. But before we get into that, just sort of a human moment with the passing of Bob Elliott over the weekend. Is a guy that we got to know a little bit. We don't get to know the assistant coaches that well, just based on we don't have a whole lot of interaction with him. But Bob Elliott always made you feel like you knew him, even if you really didn't. And that was, I think, pretty obvious on social media over the weekend after his passing in a long battle with cancer, almost 20 years. There was not a situation where you felt like, well, only the safeties connected with him. You know, it was quarterbacks, linebackers, offensive linemen, defensive linemen, coaches. Former assistant coaches, head coaches. His service is going to be, I believe the visitation is on Friday in Iowa, and the funeral itself is on Saturday. I mean, that's probably going to be Brian Kelly, Bob Stoops, Bill Snyder, Dan McCartney. I mean, that is going to be a who's who, really, of Midwest football over 25, 30 years. I mean, it's really incredible to think how many people he really touched and affected.
Yeah, just a better person than coach. You see that written and talked about a lot, but he clearly was. You know, you mentioned we don't get to talk to them very often. We probably talked to Bob Elliott 9 or 10 times total, but by the time it was the second time, he was just, hey, you know, he knows your name. He sits down, he answers every question. I wrote about it on Monday. At one point, it was probably 2013 spring and end of the interviews, and everybody's kind of, you know, we're kind of leaving because the spring's over, the Blue Bowl game's coming up, and there's probably 6 or 8 of us there, and Jack was with me, and he comes down the steps, and you're thinking, you know, maybe he wants to get something over with. It's 5 o'clock at night, he can get on with his life. Just sits down and holds court, answers every question, 18 to 20 minutes. I mean, he's a great guy to talk to about football, and he's a great guy to talk to about other things as well, and that's why players like Mathias Farley hold him so dearly. Farley tweeted out, you know, he changed my life. I remember one time interviewing Elliott in the preseason, and he said, you know, I told Mathias, who's one of my favorite kids on the team, you're fat. This is what you need to do. And he made Mathias Farley into basically a 4-year starter at Notre Dame.
Yeah, and now an NFL player.
He did change his life.
Yeah, I spent some time talking to Joe Schmidt, among other players, on Monday about Bob Elliott, and, you know, Joe flew from basically San Francisco to Chicago. Mathias was in Europe on vacation, flew to Chicago. They met at O'Hare, rented a car, drove to Iowa just to spend really like 3 hours there with the family because things had declined so quickly with Coach Elliott. And Joe said he was just so struck by, you know, you get there and it's like, oh, that's the Joe Schmidt, Mathias Farley of Iowa, and that's the Joe Schmidt and Mathias Farley of Kansas State, and that's the Joe Schmidt and Mathias Farley of Iowa State. And once you start to multiply the effect that Bob Elliott had on coaches and players outside of just Notre Dame, where he was just 5 years in a 35-year career, it really gets mind-blowing to think how many people he really affected. But I think so often we look at the impact a coach had on a player and only think about it in terms of Mathias Farley, starter, now in the league a little bit. But it's, yeah, I talked to Buster Sheridan, who was a walk-on, who we never talked to, and Nicky Baratti, who, you know, didn't really have a career here at all due to injuries. And I mean, the impact that Bob Elliott had on those guys was just as much, but we don't know it because they're not playing, so we're not writing about them. And, you know, Nicky Baratti's talking to me about how, he's crying in Bob Elliott's office before his senior year because he wanted to quit the team. He wasn't getting reps. Well, what's the point? And Elliott says, look, you've come this far. You're here for a reason. Like, don't quit now. And, you know, in the end, Baratti sticks with it. Doesn't really play a whole lot, but, you know, he talked about going out to dinner with Bob Elliott and his wife and inviting them to his wedding. And, you know, he couldn't make it, but he came to the engagement party instead. Mm-hmm. And like, Bob Elliott was the quintessential coach that you wanted to come to your wedding. And Like there's
Plenty that you don't.
There is sure. plenty that you don't. I mean, I think college football is more corporate than it's ever been, and Bob Elliott's sort of old schoolness isn't yelling and screaming and being tough. It's much more of a human touch that I think a lot of coaches just don't have anymore because they either feel like they don't have time for it or they make so much money they don't feel like they need to make time for it.
And I think it's you touched on it, the latter. That's huge in that equation. And also, he's the ultimate teacher because he cares. He cared about the player. It wasn't just trying to teach to get the point of the defense across.
And, yeah.
You know, he had some challenges to try to get the point of that defense across that he was in on at the tail end. So it's hard to understand that stuff.
Yeah, and that was one thing Schmidt said was just like, he was not going to BS you if he didn't have the answer for you right then. He would have the answer for you tomorrow. But he was so authentic with the players. I think they really appreciated that. And I thought that, you know, it came through talking to these guys, whether it be Anualu and Schmidt or Baradi and Sheridan. It certainly came through talking to Kerry Cooks and Tony Alford, both of, you know, Kerry Cooks said Bob Elliott, you know, he wasn't like a second dad to me. He was my dad because I never had a relationship with my dad. And, you know, Alford said, you know, there were things that they were on staff at Iowa State together, were things that Bob Elliott told him there that he still applies at Ohio State. And one of the things was like, if you're yelling all the time, what's really important? And Alford's like, yeah, I still use that today. And he said, you know, the impact of Bob Elliott, they were having a conversation about Bob Elliott in the Ohio State staff meeting on Monday, you know, and not all those guys coach with him, right? A bunch of them don't even know him, but there are enough due that stuff goes on. And, you know, there's just a connection there and a respect that, is really unique. So it was cool to do those interviews and all, you know, putting together a story. And it's 1,500 words now. I feel like it's going to go on to 6,000.
You had another interview this morning.
Yes.
Shifting gears and talking about hiring good teachers, right?
Yeah.
Jack Swarbrick.
Yeah, no question. I sat down with Jack Swarbrick under the premise. I wanted to talk a lot about facilities and investment in the infrastructure of the football program. And we did do that. We also talked about Chip Long and Mike Elko. We talked about scheduling Shamrock Series, going international, but you know, the point of it was, you know, I've been talking to Brian Kelly about, okay, what does Goog 2.0 need to look like? What does the second indoor need to look like? You know, that was something we reported last September, that was going to happen. There's no timeline for when it will happen, but instead of building another field parallel to the current Loftus, actually just going to enclose the third practice field at LaBar, which is a grass field. I don't know if they'll then swap out the grass to one of the other ones so right. They have an outdoor grass field or what, but I think it's an interesting way to do it. It certainly makes it more football specific, and Swarbrick talked a lot about like their NCAA legislation with time demands now where, you know, you can't start before 6 a.m. and there are evening cutoffs and breaks in the day, that they felt like they need this. And if you've been inside the Loftus Center, it is like working out in a warehouse, not in a rustic, charming kind of way, in a bad way. And I think certainly the aesthetics of this new field, whatever it is, will be an improvement as well.
It was rustic and charming when I was in college, but now it's just dank and makes you feel like you wish you were doing something different. And it's the only time covering the sport, you're just like, what? What is this?
Yeah.
You know, it's
not good.
It's ridiculous, but I never would have guessed. I don't think you would have either that
No.
You're enclosing the third field to make an outdoor practice field or make it another indoor practice field.
That's, yeah, I figured the woods north of the current field were out.
It's a forward thinking. It makes it easier.
It's
not as massive of a project.
You already have the space there to do it. You know, we also talked about what needs to go in the Goog as it gets renovated. Certainly training table, he's like, this is ridiculous. To have it served in the recruiting lounge, more recovery spaces, unclear what the investment in the recovery technology will be in those spaces, you know, but we talked about cold laser technology. You know, it's not just 20 more ice baths. They need to go above and beyond that. And then academic space, because it has less to do with like, it's not so much that you couldn't go over to the library and do it, but they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we save a half hour a day? Because without question, and Brian Kelly said that, and plenty of people in the athletic department have told me this over the years, lack of sleep is their number one issue. So if you can create that half hour that then gets paid back in rest and recovery, that's the big bonus there. So that's instead of having set up in hallways and meeting rooms, and he also said just film study, the way that needs to be done differently than it is now. So it was curious to hear that the lessons of the last 5 years are less fixed space, more flexible, scalable space, which is difficult to place when you build everything in brick.
Yeah, and bottom line, just looking at your notes, you also talked about a different type of investment they made in January or December last year in the head coach. And we talked about we've talked about it since with all the hires, with especially, I think you could bring in you could even bring in two coordinators, but when you overhaul a strength and conditioning staff of two coordinators and bring in a whole new position of special teams coordinator, it's not a 1 year investment. And we've already noted, it's a 1 year investment if they go 4-8 again, because you just can't come back from something like that. But it is a long term thing, and it's good that he's kind of set it. It's Brian Kelly is the guy that they need to win over the next 3 years.
Yeah, it's I think if they were going to dump the head coach, they would have done it in December or January of 2016, 2017. It's not happening this year, and I think we've touched on this podcast, like, okay, what's the number? And it's kind of a crude question, but I wanted to ask it and just say, all right, this is how it works in my profession. So I'm going to ask like the hot seat question, because I don't get the sense based on all the investments. And we had talked for a half hour at that point about infrastructure and recruiting coaches, BK being a little bit different, more CEO, because he feels like that's the biggest strength of his. And he feels like Sorbrook feels now more than at any point in the last 8 years, BK is in a position to actually act that way. But I said, okay, it sure sounds like this is a long-term thing. This is a 2 to 3 year project, not it didn't work out this year, bye. And it's not that.
Oh, it's calamity. Obviously that ends.
Nor is he going to come and say that it is a 1 year project and everyone's job is on the line. That's just how college football works. But their perspective is much more, I think, BK 3.0, and see how this shakes out over 2017, 2018, 2019. Similarly to, I think, how you used to describe Brian Van Gorder, that it was a 3 year project. It was never going to be more than a 3 year project, but it was probably going to be a 3 year project.
Should have been a 2 year project.
Right.
Was the key there. But it was, we're not the decision makers on this thing.
No. So. But we talked a little bit about how Brian Kelly's, I think, most inspired hires have been guys that have not been in his coaching tree. And Sorbrook made the point that he feels, one, he agrees with that premise, and that he, Stan, and Sanford were successful enough that it paved the way for Long, Elko, Bayless to come in. Now, 4-8 probably need to happen for those wheels to be set in motion. But I said, my theory was that it showed quite a bit of confidence in yourself to then go outside your coaching comfort zone in a make or break year on paper and make those hires. And Sorbrook's like, I agree with that. Like that shows a level of confidence in that you're going to get this fixed.
I do think he had to. And I also want to say that, when he comes in originally, Brian Kelly, you're bringing your own guys with you.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's
because
not the issue.
Won 33 games at Cincinnati.
Exactly. But that's where the offseason evaluation comes in. You're at a different level of football. And that's where probably quicker evaluation could have come into play.
Yeah, no question. Scheduling Arkansas on, I think it's 2020 and 2025. We talked a little bit about that. Said, I don't know, Notre Dame made a point of like, oh, it's a first-time opponent. And he's like, that's fine, but not really that big of a deal. The bigger deal was Arkansas giving them flexibility to split the games by 5 years. That's fairly rare.
Yeah, that's it.
But that's what they needed. And also that they would like to have more SEC markers on their schedule in the same way that they always have two Pac-12 markers, ACC, obviously, usually one Big Ten, and then the SEC maybe more than the Big 12, which everyone here would agree that you're better off having a point of comparison to the league that's sometimes getting two teams in than the league that's sometimes getting no teams in. So that's where they are with that.
And it's different to have a 5-year marker with a team from the SEC than, say, Nevada, who they had a 6-year marker with right. those plates. So that's, well, no, and the 2020 gives it a chance to have Bielema Kelly, too. That's a nice, you can kind of talk about it. 2025, Kelly has already talked about how he'll be having a mind time.
To yeah, Bielema won't be there either.
Yeah, he tends to move around a little bit. But.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, they're in a situation now where Georgia, A&M, Arkansas, and like I think mentally I'm not in this place where for some reason I don't think of Arkansas and A&M as SEC teams. No. A&M for obvious reasons, Arkansas maybe less so, but Georgia, that is like heart of the SEC, so they have that coming up. That will be a huge marker, as they like to say. And let's see, what else have we got? Hoops, you were watching hoops practice. It's
odd in July.
Right? Yes. I have a hard time with them in October.
No, it's harder in October, yeah. Actually. This is a refreshing change. But yeah, it was open for, it was going to be an hour. It went a little longer. There's a lot of heavy scrimmage near the end, which was fun. Actually, kind of one of the highlights was there was a very competitive 3-on-3 part where I don't think you're supposed to score more than a couple times in a row. But Matt Farrell transferred Juwan Durham, and Nicky Dojo, they're calling him Nicky, who... the three of them were lighting up, and as good as DJ Harvey looked, they were lighting up. DJ Harvey, the freshman, John Mooney, who's, you know, one of the guys they really need to come along, and kind of a rotation for the third guy in there. And it was just showing Matt Farrell with the basketball in his hand. He controls this team. But kind of the takeaways from, since Durham's not going to play, he's a different level athlete. It's going to be good to have him on the team next year. I know there's the silver line. Everybody's saying he's not fully healthy yet. I would like to see a almost healthy Durham with Bonzi Colson on this team. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen, but it really helps Notre Dame in the future. And kind of the takeaways I think fans would want to know, DJ Harvey just, he is, I've kind of been describing him from film as a swing man. He is definitely a small forward at this level, which is a good thing because they're bringing in guards. He's a little bigger than I gave him credit for, and he plays a little bit bigger. He, in 3 years...
Built or tight?
He's thicker.
Okay.
He's just thicker. Built. In 3 years, he'll be able to kind of bang. Mm-hmm. A little bit down there, and then he has good explosiveness for a young guy, but his is just a learning curve. And like Bray mentioned, he just gets totally lost covering pick and rolls. They don't have to, and it's not just being the guy that's getting picked. It's like if you have to hug the shooter, but you still have to help out a little bit. Yeah. He has absolutely no idea, but he shows some flashes late offensively. And you know, my two takeaways that matter for the rotation. You're gonna immediately smile. I wish this was on camera. Martin Gebben,
okay,
is bigger. He's playing to his frame. Does that make sense? He's a 6'10", 250-pound guy who, when he comes over to help, looks 6'10", 250 pounds. So he's getting in the way of layups. He's altering a little bit of free movement. He's playing to his frame.
He's available.
Yes, he's available. He's like the fish.
He's on the menu.
No, he is. He's playing to his frame. But and Rex Pfluger was looking for his offense. I shouldn't just say a shot because I don't think Notre Dame fans want Rex Pfluger to be hunting 20-footers all game long, even though he's a pretty good open shooter. He was just looking to contribute more offensively because they have to find, I'm not sure they need to find a third score like everybody's asking, but they need to find a third score every night. It doesn't have to be the same guy. Bray mentioned that's Gibbs. It could be Pfluger. It could be Gibbs. It's not Matt Ryan who transferred out. I think I saw on the board, they won't miss Matt Ryan, but they're going to miss his skill set. And I agree with that after watching practice.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a great shooting team.
Farrell's a great shooter, and then everybody else is not the shooting level of... anywhere close to the shooting level of Matt Ryan, Farrell, going back in time, all the guys they've always had there. VJ Beachum, when he's open not in his head, and on. I don't think they're a great shooting team, but I do think that they are going to be justified being but the fifth pick in the ACC preseason. They could, you know, there's a lot of good talent coming into that league. They lost a lot of talent in that league, but talent always comes in.
Yeah.
But they do have one of the 5 best players and 2 of the 10 best players in the league.
Yeah, that will get you a long way in basketball. So, yeah, I'll be very curious to see how that team develops because it's wired differently than a lot of Bray teams, even though it feels very Bray-esque in terms of, like, the 3-star, 4-year player in Farrell and Colson.
They just became much better than 3- and 2-star players in Farrell and Colson. I mean, Farrell has no... There's no 2-star left in Medford.
No.
He does not. And Bonzi Colson, there was a moment when, actually, Colson got a steal, and this is kind of a moment where I thought, boy, they'd love to have Durham in there. Mm-hmm. Durham hustles back, and Colson didn't even challenge him one-on-one on the break. He pulled it out, took his time. Once his teammates joined him, he ended up backing down. I think it was Harvey and laying it in. And Ryan Ayers is the head, their assistant coach right there on the sideline, just turns and said, freshman versus senior. And that's what Bonzi Colson has a senior's game. Mm-hmm. And
there Which was head for a few years.
It is. He's got an old man's game, and now he's officially an old man. So yeah. he'll be able to score again.
Yeah, quick, before we get out of segment one, Dane Goodwin committed, shooting guard, at their third top 100 commitment. They are tied for the lead on scout.com, at least in terms of top 100 players committed, with USC. And they have more top 100 players committed than the football program. So riddle me that, Tim O'Malley.
I can't answer that one, but you never in the history of scout.com clicked on recruiting rankings that began in 2002 officially on a website and seen Notre Dame sitting at number 5. Yeah. In basketball. So yeah, this is, they have some momentum. You know, I'm sure it's going to rejuvenate Mike Bray. This is kind of the last ride of those Elite Eight guys. It's a new team after, once Colson and Farrell are gone, you're moving into the kind of the final stages, I would think. This is my 4 years. These are the guys I'm bringing in.
Maybe the last stage of Bray, really.
No, that's what I was referring to. Okay, I think this would be his last stage. This freshman class kind of going through. Because it is turning the page. You'll have leftover guys, of course, mm-hmm. that have some culture, as he's always fond of saying. But the guys that made those runs, this is it. This is really the end of it. I don't know if his reloading counts with Notre Dame.
It's close.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, they could be better in the next 2 years than they will be this year. And this is a year where they can challenge for the second weekend again.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you throw, if they can skip a step in development with Durham, Hobb, Gibbs,
Harvey
in there. I mean, that's a really athletic looking group of guys. And then if you have, you know, the Goodwin, Carmody group,
right?
If they can just shoot it, you know, like a specialist's way, that's all you need to do to really fit in. And it'll be a very interesting team a year from now, once Farrell and Colson depart. So that's it for segment one, Irish Illustrated Insider. Got a bunch of questions for our readers, so we'll get into all that next.
Welcome back to segment two of Irish Illustrated Insider, burning up the boards. Our first question goes across a few sports. Golden by name. In baseball, they have sabermetrics, and in basketball, they also have advanced analytics. What do you see as a non-traditional stat in football that might be overlooked by the general audience, but can be a key indicator of a team's performance?
Yeah, I don't think there's ever going to be a OPS war in football. There's just too many variables, and I think especially in college football, to take it a step further, there are variables on top of variables because of the opponents you're playing,
right.
And just the wide range of that. But stats that I find interesting that maybe don't get talked a lot about, I think run game efficiency is something I've been tracking the last couple years. And basically the premise of that is if you're a home run hitting running back, but you're getting stuffed on third and two, like that counts the same. So it's to get 60% of the necessary yardage on first down. I'm sorry, 40% on first down, 60% on second down, 100% on third down or fourth down. And that is, I think, a much more true indicator of how your run game is going than yards per carry. And I think there's some stats that, like, I don't even know why that's, like, yards per carry is, I don't want to say a waste of a stat, but it's not indicative of what you're doing in the same way that I think, you know, total offense, total defense is based on the variance and pace of play.
Well, and also,
it's got to be yard. Yeah.
If you're up by 35 points, the yards allowed are just totally useless.
To me, I'm much more yards per play. That's what I want to know. I want to know how efficient is your offense yards per play? How much are you giving up yards per play?
I actually saw a message board post years ago. Someone claimed that, and I never researched this, someone claimed that if you average 2 yards more, 2 yards is the benchmark, more than your opponent for the season, that is all, the top level teams always average at least 2 more yards per play than their opponents do for the season. So let's say you average 7.3 yards per play, you're holding your opponents to 5.3 yards per play. I'd like to, you know, the problem is you got to look into that for more than one team mm-hmm. for it to be relevant, but that goes to your point. How many yards per play are you getting and are you giving up? Not an easy one to track doing it that way. As I said, they're looking for the general audience as well. So I think, look, third down defense has always been kind of a telltale for me. Last year, Michigan was the best at it. They weren't the best team, but they were one of the best defenses. Other teams in the top 10 include Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, who I think we all know had pretty good years last season. There's an outlier, and Oklahoma was kind of down in the 30s as the other playoff team. But then you have teams like Wisconsin, Washington, Boston College that are known for their defense, and LSU, and that's third down efficiency. Look, Notre Dame was terrible at it. They were great in 2012, of course. I think if you're going to use red zone defense, you're looking at so many variables and outliers and freak mistakes that happen. That's probably not one that will carry over all the time. But I think if you have a good third down defense, you're probably going to have a good defense. Getting off the field is the point. It's not like you're giving up touchdowns left and right on second down. So the third down defense is one. And the one we use on for an individual player, it's probably why I was so high on Isaac Rochelle, the junior, is stuffs. Tackles near the line of scrimmage, and it does not count if it's second and three and the guy gains 2 yards. I don't record it as a stuff. You didn't really do your...
It's the inverse of rushing run game efficiency.
Exactly. That's not... But if it's, you know, third and three and you make a tackle for a 2 yard gain, and...
Same thing.
But if it's in opposing territory, that's great because they're going to punt it.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, stuffs is a thing because that year, you know, Isaac Rochelle actually had more than Sheldon Day when the two were on the team. And, together, but I'm sure Sheldon Day helped him out with that one. So, stats are tough in football. You said there's so many variables, like Sheldon Day drawing a double team, Isaac Rochelle against the stuff. So there's, I would say if you're looking for a team stat, yards per play and yards per play against the measure over the course of time will work out for you.
All right, ND615. On the heels of the Arkansas series announcement, what 2 to 3 non-ACC schools would you like to see Notre Dame schedule most? For home and home, feel free to be selfish with your answers.
Does that mean like Pepperdine to be selfish? Because that would be a fun trip. But I would say I've never been to Oregon, so I'd love to go. I've been to the state. I've never been to outside.
I didn't write that one
down. Yeah, I'd love to have a home and home with Oregon. Be a rough night game on the road for the team in the blue and gold probably, but it'd be fun to cover. For a place I've been and would love to go back, I've been a couple times, is Tennessee has always just been a great, all-time great game day atmosphere for me. And I actually did not make the trip out to Washington. I was on my honeymoon. So I would love to see that stadium. And
especially now that it's been renovated.
Yeah, especially now. But that would be another one for me.
Yeah, I was going through, I think I've covered 52 road games. Not neutral, so like road venues.
Road venues.
And I've been, all of one of those was an SEC team. Tennessee in 2003. Yes. That was the last one. So I was partial to Alabama, LSU, Florida. I would love to see what those environments were like. I have never been to Ohio State, even though I feel like Notre Dame is playing Ohio State a lot. It's not actually
it's
the case.
Yeah.
But I think also, you know, this is not really a marquee game, but I would love to see Notre Dame do a true home-and-home with Navy and a true home-and-home with Army.
The Army would be great.
I think that would just be incredible.
Yeah.
And a cool statement on top of it.
I lived in the South for 10 years, so I have gone to those places not to see a Notre Dame game, but I will tell you that this will be a quick podcast tangent. Florida, Spurrier's there. They're playing Mississippi State. It's in 2000 or 2001. Whatever happened the year before, they lost to Mississippi State. And they are winning 45-0 in their revenge match. And there's 2 minutes left, and no one has left. And Mississippi State is going for it on 4th-and-1 at midfield. And you can't hear yourself think at 45-0. They stop them. And then to make the story, Brock Berlin, the freshman, comes in as the backup quarterback to kneel the ball out. Only he does a play-action pass bomb touchdown to win 52-45. And Spurrier says it's because they ran over our trainer in the celebration last year. That's for him. So that's what you might get in Florida sometime in your life. Good times.
That would be fun to see. MMB4. What should we expect from Brandon Wimbush this year? New quarterback play or star in the making type of year?
Because it said star in the making, I'm kind of on that. I don't think he's going to be a top five college football quarterback this year, but I do think it will be star in the making. You can see how good he is. I know that there's going to be some mistakes. I don't necessarily believe that he has to throw 10 interceptions like it seems to be the popular sentiment right now because he's a rookie. He's a junior rookie that's got a lot of talent around him. And a lot, can I use arm talent? Am I not a former coach or scout? But I'm going to say arm talent and leg talent Leg talent. He has leg talent.
He can make all the runs.
That's right. He can make all the runs with his ankles. So, yeah, I think he's a star in the making. It won't be the best year of his career, but there's a reason. I guess there's two reasons he's listed on the Heisman Watch on sportsbook.com.
One's he goes to Notre Dame.
And number two is he's actually a pretty good talent quarterback coming in.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it still goes back. I think the principle applies even if the statistic is not exactly true, is that Brian Kelly, I think he's 21-5 with a freshman or redshirt freshman quarterback. I realize that Wimbush is a junior or redshirt sophomore, no matter how you want to spin that, but he hasn't played really any meaningful football and hasn't been on the field in 2 years. So I think that's a reason to believe that the offense will be very good and Brandon Wimbush will be a part of the reason it's really good, even if he's not the reason that it's really good.
How surprised would you be if he is the problem?
How surprised would I be if Brandon Wimbush is the problem of Notre Dame offensively? Pretty surprised.
I would be too.
Pretty surprised.
That's the way I look at it. I don't think he's holding them back.
I
don't mean the Georgia game when it's 3rd-and-8 and it's middle of the third quarter. I'm not saying he's going to be prepared for that, but I think over the course of the season, I think if he struggles against either Georgia or his first road game, that he's much better against USC in his next road game is kind of how I look at it.
This is an O'Malley type of question, but give me your level of concern among speed at the wide receiver position, the right tackle, and the quarterback.
I'm 1-5, 1 being the lowest, 1 at quarterback. I don't believe there's a problem.
All right.
2, because it's humanly possible. How's that? Or 1 yet.
No, but biggest concern to least concern among those three things.
The right tackle.
Oh, he's number 1?
Speed of wide receiver, because I do think Kevin Stefferson will be in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wimbush wouldn't be 3. You got to find me a few more things for me before I go to with Wimbush. So that's, right. I go that way. I think right tackle, I think you play some good defenses this year and you have a redshirt freshman in there. I think without Stefferson, I would bump that up.
Okay.
I think he'll be in the mix.
Point being, Wimbush is 3.
Yes. Yeah, I don't have real concern over Wimbush. I have him as not the strength of the team, but I think he will be one of the top 10 players on the team.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Irish Grizz 53. Is there much hope for Trombetti and Kareem, allowing Jay Hayes to help out of the 3 technique, defensive tackle? I feel like he needs to be able to log some Rochelle-type snaps in case Ewell, Hinnish, or Tagovailoa, Mosa play like 18-year-old linemen, which is very fair. Or does Jay Hayes even have that ability in him?
If the question is Jay Hayes needs to log Isaac Rochelle snaps?
Inside. They want him to move inside.
Okay. Opposed to the volume of snaps, which is often 100% of them.
He can't have that many. He can't do real Rochelle snaps, which is he played more snaps than were in a game you once tracked.
You know,
he really did.
Yeah. That's true. True story. I think Jay Hayes inside is a very interesting dynamic. But I don't think the solution would be Trombetti or Kareem. I think it would be Julian Okwara had an amazing offseason out of nowhere, and they get Dalen Hayes and Julian Okwara on the field at the same time with Jay Hayes moving inside with Tillery. So let's say you get in a situation where it's 3rd and whatever, and you go Hayes, Tillery, Okwara. That suddenly looks like a fairly athletic, somewhat young, but athletic defensive line that could actually get some pressure. I don't know where Trombetti and Kareem fit into that mix, but I like the idea of Jay Hayes moving inside on 3rd down. That's not a solution on 1st and 10.
Right.
He has to be the strong side defensive end.
I completely agree. I think you could see it on 3rd down. I'm not sure why not, unless Bonner shows that ability to get to the passer, but I don't think he would better than Jay Hayes from the inside position. And Bonner needs rest if he's the starting 3 technique, which he is set for right now. And, you know, Kareem, we just haven't heard enough about from the coaches to think he could step in right now. It doesn't mean I'm not talking about his career, but have you heard him?
No. And it's not even somebody that you hear about behind the scenes either. You know, it's not even the chatter guy of like, oh, this guy's having a really good offseason. So it makes you wonder if he's like, maybe he's 6 months away. Maybe he's a year away.
Maybe he should have redshirted.
Yeah, but they're Trombetti and Hayes. Trombetti's definitely gone. Hayes, you would hope, would be back. But Khalid Kareem still has, take this year out, he's still got 2 years where he has to play a big role.
Yeah, and I mentioned that he should have redshirted. There's the theory that he did. We can't get to the bottom of this because I think it's kind of like, it's going to be a thing where they're going to have to apply because he played in games, and there's that.
Yeah.
He's listed on UND.com as playing like six games, but that didn't happen. So that's just a mistake listing, but I'm not clear. I have put the official question in, and it's just not clear yet. But for people listening, he may actually have a fifth year of eligibility. I just can't prove it, and I don't think you'll be able to until 2020.
Stay tuned. All right, PD Halls. Where's the disconnect between the talent and results in regards to the defense? It's easy to say that Notre Dame needs to recruit more talent on the defensive line, but in reality, safety aside, if you started some combo of Tillery, Jay Hayes, Daniel Cage, Dalen Hayes, Sean Crawford, Nick Watkins, Asmar Bilal, Drew Tranquil, Niles Morgan, Dante Vaughn, Khalid Kareem, Elijah Taylor, Greer Martini, those were all four-star guys on scout, with Morgan being a five-star. How many teams in the country could start a four-star player at almost every position?
I'm just glad that Jay Hayes and Khalid Kareem are in two questions
back-to-back
in July, which means we have done our job talking about concerns and strengths on the team. Yeah, I actually wrote about this on Monday. If you look at it, the average star ranking on the offense is four. That is the starting 11 plus the backup at every position. And the average star rating on the defense is 3.75. That includes one five-star in Morgan. A little handful of three-stars, and they are all in the secondary. One of them, I think, has outperformed that already in Julian Love. And then there are a few question marks. They have enough star-ranking talent to have a defense better than we are painting it. But I think it's interconnected in that their issues are pass rush and young safeties.
Yeah.
If their issues were something else and something else, we wouldn't be lamenting the defensive setup for at least the beginning of the season. Because there's not a pass rusher unless it's Dalen Hayes, or unless you said someone comes out of nowhere like Aquara, and they're young at safety and inexperienced. And I mean, Nick Coleman and Jalen Elliott are set to start at safety, and Nick Coleman's the sixth best corner, and Elliott was playing offense 2 years ago.
Yeah, on top of that, if you ask around Notre Dame about Alohi Gilman, they'll tell you, hey, he might be the best safety on the team, which is okay.
Glad he's on the team.
But a Navy transfer who was sort of All-American Conference would be your best safety. That's not a healthy position to be in. I agree. It's just they are weak at the wrong spots. If we were talking about Notre Dame has a real weakness at nickelback and will linebacker, I don't think we would have much of a concern. Or even forget nickel, just starting corner. Yeah. They're unproven and I think under-talented a lot of positions. Now, to answer the question, how many teams in the country could start a four-star player at almost every position? Well, some of these guys aren't starting that have been listed here. So Notre Dame's not going to start a four-star at every position because Julian Love is going to start. And Jalen Elliott was a three-star prospect. Whether it's Devin Studsell, Nick Coleman, those are three-star prospects. Yeah. They're starting. Bonner's probably going to start. So Notre Dame won't start a four-star player every position. Almost every team in the top 25, in the top 15 could, but that's not really the point. You know, the point is how many difference makers on the college level do you see in all the names you listed? So far, we've seen zero. I think that Dalen Hayes will be one.
Sean Crawford could be one.
Crawford, when healthy, is one.
Niles Morgan will be one.
Niles Morgan would be the closest. Tranquil, I think, will be one in this defense specifically.
You've heard nothing, but just in case people have been listening the whole time of the summer, you've heard nothing but great things about Drew Tranquil at this position in the defense from inside the Goog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not on the record, so that's even better.
All-American NFL is like, they have huge expectations for him. And I think Tillery, if he bounces back and gets his head on straight, has a chance to be very good too. But
I'm going to sigh for Priester not being here right now and just put something here.
Yeah, Tim would like to put in absentia, Priester's protesting my Tillery comment. But they have some guys on defense, but they don't have studs on defense that are really going to, I think, move the needle. And that's what Ohio State and Alabama and Clemson, they have a ton of the guys like that. So that's the position they're in. All right, last word. Tennessee Al. Any word on the incoming freshmen and how they're doing in summer workouts?
You had a large thread on this, and the main takeaway for me was Heinisch and having, well, that Tagovailoa, Mosa, and Hynish looked very good, and that Ewell did not. I think that's the opposite of what we have been kind of talking about since Ewell took up swimming and was our number one across the board incoming recruit by Irish Illustrated. So why don't you elaborate on the issue?
Yeah, like, shockingly, the media thought a four-star player was better than two three-star players. But yeah, what I had heard was that stock way up on Tagovailoa, Mosa, they're very impressed with him. Hynish, they sort of love everything about. I don't know if he's a super high ceiling guy, but you know, the Irish A to Z in me is like, who do we compare these to? Guys that they look like. So you're going to compare him to Pat Kuntz. And I was told, look, he's way better than that. And Pat Kuntz was a productive player. Kurt Hynish, I think, is going to be a productive player earlier than that. Maybe even earlier than Darnell Ewell, which was a bit surprising to me because I think we all expected him to fight for reps early on, and it sounds like Hynish, if Temple was tomorrow, Hynish maybe would get on the field and Ewell wouldn't. So that's when you look at Notre Dame's defensive line depth, it's great that Tagovailoa, Amosa, and Hynish are really impressing, but it's a concern that Ewell is not. The other one is Cole Komet is just looks amazing, and I think we could have told you that after watching him. I think it was spring practice. Yeah, it was
right?
Out at LeBar.
Yeah,
and he looks like a college junior. Between him and Brock Wright,
I mean,
they're set for 3 years minimum, and like I think you got to set it at 3 years because maybe one of them is going to go pro after the junior year. I mean, there's just a lot of material in those two guys.
Hey, play them, you know, they always redshirt one of those tight ends in the situation, but if they're that good, you play them both if they can help you because there's no fifth year for a tight end that's that good anymore.
Yes.
You didn't get the fifth year out of, I shouldn't even say the name Tyler Eifert, but you don't get the fifth year out of Eifert, you don't get the fifth year out of Fasano, you didn't get a fourth year out of Rudolph, he was an NFL player when he stepped on campus. Didn't get a fourth year out of Nicholas, which is worse than not getting a fourth year out of Rudolph because you didn't see that coming. You know, they didn't redshirt Koyak, and they could have.
Could he have returned? Yeah.
Yeah, he probably could have, too, and Smythe, of course, needed it. But in Mac, you're not going to get a fifth year out of it. I mean, you might not get a fourth.
Right.
But, yeah, play them if they can help, right?
Yeah, because I don't think either of those guys are five-year players here. But if they are truly committed to being a more of a two tight end type offense, there's going to be a huge role for those guys. And throw in Michael Young and Jordan Genmar-Keith. Those are two other guys that were mentioned to me as like stock up. They like what they have. For Genmar-Keith, I thought that was really significant just because he hasn't played a lot of football. And he's a guy that maybe is also sort of in between positions, is a bigger body safety type. But
they like him as an athlete or at a position?
I'm not really sure. I think that they just like what they see early on. They're not, you know, installing the defense top to bottom in June, but in terms of a guy and his fit, I think that they like what they see there, and that to me is, it's good news because not everyone comes in ready to go.
How about Vernaglia? How's he looked in the summer?
Yeah,
as always,
million bucks.
There's always a guy that looks great every summer. So let's
there's I hopefully people are not listening to this podcast and saying like, my takeaway was that Kurt Hynish will be a freshman All-American. No, I think it's Kurt Hynish could be a factor in a rotation this year. And the same with Genmar-Keith. I think the only guy that you could, after listening to this podcast, would be reasonable to think, wow, he's very impressive, is Cole Komet. And that's, I'm just talking the mid-year enrollees, not the early enrollees, because I think we know what they've seen. And that was another guy I talked to, somebody around the offensive line will say about Robert Hainsey, and he's like, I said, he was really impressive to me. What do you think? And he's like, yeah, don't be surprised if he plays this year. I'm like, this year? And he said, yeah, I think you'll see him in a competition at right tackle with Eichenberg and Kramer, maybe for time this year. So Hainsey is another guy, even though he's an early enrollee, not to be overlooked because they are incredibly high in this guy out of the gate. So it'd be fairly interesting to see how that unfolds. All right, well, that's it for Irish Illustrated Insider. We're gonna end on that upbeat note. I think we'll be back next week, hopefully with
three rookie right tackles, as upbeat as we get, right?
Yeah, no, 2 weeks down the road maybe with Tim Priester full booth at that point. So until our next podcast, you've been listening to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. He is Tim O'Malley. I'm Pete Sampson. Thanks for listening.